The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Welcome. I'm going to go ahead and get started. My name is Alexis Booth, and I am an art teacher at Cary Christian School. I actually have the privilege of teaching a very wide range of students. I teach third graders through 12th graders, and it is a joy. And most of the time, people think of me as the art teacher, the one that is teaching the production of art. But one of my greatest joys is actually being able to see students look at art and get as excited as I do about viewing great works of art. Because it doesn't have to happen just in the art classroom. It absolutely can be a part of your everyday classroom where you're exposing them and getting them excited to see how you can take images and incorporate them into your lessons that will really stick. And so that is my goal for you today, that you will find some very specific strategies and ideas for how you can make your lessons stick by using art history. Incorporating works of art into your lessons, it just offers such an amazing variety of benefits. Art appeals to students of all learning styles, particularly those that are more visual in nature. It offers a text that equalizes those with disparate reading levels. And art images provide an ideal starting point for discussion that can bridge to more abstract literary and historical issues. Finally, it encourages even reticent students to join in on class discussions. Before we can begin this type of integration, though, we must make sure that we have chosen art that will train students to see the kind of art that glorifies God as good, true, and beautiful. And I'm sure you've heard that phrase about 100 times during this conference, and many have tried to explain it. I'm not going to specifically try to explain what that means, but I am going to go through and give you kind of a visual idea of the good, the true, and the beautiful, knowing that we are constantly having to overcome the idea of art like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Or when it comes to art production, you know, art for art's sake. These myths assume that anything goes with regard to art. However, God has such a higher standard than that. The aesthetic standards of goodness, truth, and beauty they're not relative. Even without a background in art history, I don't want you to be intimidated by choosing appropriate work. As long as you have a background of a general understanding of truth, good, and goodness, and beauty, you can choose. The standards for artistic goodness come from creation itself. As we look around our world, we see excellence in creation, an unsurpassed mastery of materials and techniques. And artwork should reflect that level of effort in craftsmanship. To be pleasing to God, art must be true as well as good. Art communicates truth often by telling a story. Art is always an interpretation of reality, but this reality must be complete. It must reflect not just the suffering of a fallen world, but the hope that is achieved through grace. Art is true only if it points in some way to the true story of salvation, the story of God's creation, human sin, and the triumph of grace through Christ. Finally, God is a lover of beauty. We see this in how creation is not just about function, but about form as well. Philip Ryken expresses this sentiment so well by saying that beautiful art must delight the senses or the mind. Now, in the last few slides, I've displayed images of truly amazing artwork. These are masterworks that absolutely delight the senses and the mind. And I would hope that you would recognize most of these pieces of art. Even if you can't name the artist or the title, you can recognize the style and know that these artists clearly demonstrate truth, goodness, and beauty in their art. But how did you gain that recognition? The first step is you had to actually be exposed to the great works. The same is true for your students. In order for us to be able to train our students to appreciate great works of art, they have to know what great art looks like. Effective communication about art also must include the techniques present in the work of art. We must have a common language. We must have the grammar when discussing techniques and materials. The elements of art are to art what atoms are to science. They are the building blocks of art. And a piece of art doesn't always have all of the elements in it, but it generally has two or three, and there are a total of seven. As I briefly go through each one of these elements, I'll be giving visual examples of how they can be discussed within other contexts, beyond art interpretation and production, but rather in integrating into other disciplines, sometimes with science, sometimes with math, and other disciplines. The first one is line. It is the most basic of all of the elements. It is a mark that has greater length than width. Lines can be horizontal, vertical, diagonal, straight, curved, thick, thin. Imagine your students inspired in their study of trees with this image of the swirling, curving lines of Van Gogh's cypresses. You can feel the movement of the leaves blowing in the wind. Shape. Shape is just a closed line. Shapes can be geometric, like squares and circles, or organic, like free form or natural shapes. Shapes are flat and can express only length and width. Consider going on a shape hunt through art. Circles, squares, rectangles, they're everywhere. Color. Color is light reflected off of objects, and color has three main characteristics. The name of the color, which would be called the hue, such as red, green, blue. The value, which is how light or dark the color happens to be, and intensity, how bright or dull the color is. And you all know that students love color. Have them look for and name the primary and secondary colors within your classroom. In this example by Seurat, consider the optical illusion, the science of it, that is created with mere dots of color. Our eyes combine the dots of yellow and blue to make such a wide variety of values of green. Value. The use of lightness and darkness in a piece of artwork. Look at the amazing drama that Rembrandt creates with his use of highlighting certain characters of this painting. Our eyes are drawn to the light as they pop out, and those in darkness recede into the distance. Form. Form is an element of art that is actually three-dimensional and encloses volume. It includes height, width, and depth, as in a cube, a sphere, a pyramid, or a cylinder. Just as in a shape hunt, we can find three-dimensional shapes such as the cylindrical forms in the human body with the arms, the legs, the torso. Texture. Texture is an element of art that refers to the way things feel or look as if they might feel if you touched them. I know that you can all imagine the rough grain feel of the wood floor and the furniture and the bumpy quality of the wicker just by the way Van Gogh painted the texture. Space. Space is the area between and around objects. The space around an object is often called negative space, and negative space has shape. Space can also refer to the feeling of depth. Real space is three-dimensional. And in visual art, when we create the feeling or illusion of depth, we call it space. This really is the main challenge for an artist, creating that illusion of three dimensions on a two-dimensional piece of paper or a canvas. Now, once we have this common language, this grammar of art mastered, then discussing great works of art becomes so much easier and can lead to very practical applications, particularly in writing and history. As I go through specific activities that incorporate master art with these core subjects, you'll see that they can be applied to various grade levels, from phonics to rhetoric, based on the level of time and the detail required to complete the assignment. One of the best ways for a student to connect with art is through its narrative. Storytelling is always a natural pathway of learning. In art, the story must be interpreted by the viewer. The artist leaves us little clues, and we are left to put the pieces together. It's exciting to guide students through this process of seeing the true story of God's creation, but the absolute most critical element into deciphering the clues is to actually look at the picture, and for more than just a quick glance. So often, students miss some really great information because they don't take the time to really look at the artwork. In my classroom, I will often have what I call a gallery walk, where I'll have a number of pieces around the perimeter of the room, and I'll have the students come in slowly, viewing each piece on their way in before they actually have a seat in their assigned seat. I expect them to look for the elements of art that we've already talked about and to look for details of the subject matter. Some will want to rush, but I will illustrate right now how they can miss out on so many fun things if they don't take their time. You may have noticed I have a rubber chicken. Yes. Anybody have an idea why I would have a rubber chicken hanging around my waist? And I will tell you that you have seen a piece of art that relates to this so far. This is my point in really looking. And I know you guys are far away. This isn't as clear as I would like it to be. But there is a reason why I have a rubber chicken. Rembrandt's Night Watch. As you are looking at this piece, let me just say, I know I didn't prepare you for the amount of detail that I expected you to be looking for in any of these paintings, but your students should be prepared for that. If you look closely, you will see a dwarf that is highlighted. Now, there are many theories as to why this dwarf is there. I'm just going to give you one. In my class, I might go through some other ones, but I'm just going to give you one. That dwarf you'll see right in the center of the painting, she is highlighted, and what you will notice is she does actually have a rope around her waist with chickens hanging on it, but you had to look closely for that. Now, one of the theories is that she was a cook for this militia that Rembrandt is painting, and so naturally, a militia might be on the move a lot, and so this was something that was common during the time, that they would have the chickens and they would slaughter them and then they would hang them around their waist when they were on the move until they could get to a point that they could actually cook the chicken. But the key here is this is such a fun element of this painting that unless you actually take the time to look for it, you might not have noticed. This is something that will immediately engage your students into wanting to find the dwarf with the chicken, and to even look for more quirky elements that might be in this painting. If you don't really look, I tell this to my students all the time, you miss the jokes. And we don't want to miss the jokes because there's so many fun things to see. It is when students see the benefits of spending time with art that we as art teachers, or we as teachers can use it the most effectively. So once we've gotten their attention, how can we guide our students into unfolding the narrative and later communicating the truths of art within our curriculum? We can start by asking three basic questions. What is going on in the picture? What do you see that makes you say that? And what's the rest of the story? These questions lead to fully exploring the painting, taking an inventory of the things, the emotions, the places, the actions, and the people that are present in the work. Look for clues, and don't be afraid to use the title, the artist, sometimes the date. All of those can be clues. In this particular piece, obviously you see by the title, and I'm sure most of you guessed immediately when you saw it, that this is Daniel in the Lion's Den. What a perfect opportunity to integrate with Bible in reading the book of Daniel. And so I am going to begin with verse 16. As I am reading, I want you to be viewing this piece and filling your mind with the visual as well as the verbal reading from this book of Daniel. Starting in verse 16. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wounds were found on him because he had trusted in God. We now have a wonderful pathway to solidify these events in your students' minds. What's going on in this picture? Daniel is praying and looking up from the den with a bunch of hungry lions. What makes you say that? The expressions on the lions' faces showing that they are angry. They didn't get to eat Daniel last night. The bones show that they have eaten here before. What's the rest of the story? Continue by questioning what happened before the moment depicted in the painting. You may even want to read more of the book of Daniel, just discussing the backstory. You complete the story by discussing what happens next. Think of the power of your Bible lesson when students are viewing this art and discussing Daniel 6 together. They are able to see the hungry looks on the lions' faces, the dramatic evidence of those that had come before, and the prayerful supplication of Daniel. The drama is palpable. This strategy can be extended into writing assignments, such as journal entries that we actually use at Cary Christian School in third grade. Some type of copy of the artwork is very helpful, such as a line drawing from a coloring book, the student's own imitation of the art, or just a black and white copy of the art can be used. And this is a great thing for your early finishers as well, because not only is the focus the writing, but then you have an opportunity to allow them to color the image if they should finish early. Their writing should combine the elements of the language of art as well as the narrative. But the art chosen doesn't necessarily need to be biblical in nature. At our school, the classroom teachers use art that are part of our art history curriculum, thereby integrating information that would have originally been taught in art class. However, the possibilities are endless, particularly with historical images. Another way to integrate art history into your curriculum is to use it for a theme of poetry. When it comes to art, including poetry, one of the most stressful types of assignment you can give, particularly a logic or a rhetoric student, is to tell them to write, or in my case, draw, anything they want. Oh, that sounds great. No, it's not great. They hate that. They'll look like deer in the headlights. What am I going to talk about? And so this gives them something to focus on to integrate it with whatever your lesson might be with the written language. So a simple type of poetry that works well across grade levels is a syncane poem. And while there can be different forms of a syncane, this is the one that I've used with success. And you'll see a syncane is a five-line poem that does not rhyme. Line one is a noun. Line two are two adjectives that describe the noun. Line three are three action words ending in ing. Line four is a short statement about the topic. And line five is a noun that is a synonym for line one. To begin with, once again, it is critical that the student spend some serious time looking at the artwork. Again, the language of art and the narrative should be explored. When asking the three basic questions, this piece gives us a great opportunity to use our imagination as to the rest of the story, since this one is not based on a written account. What's going on in this picture? Students should be encouraged to take notes on their thoughts. There are rough seas, stormy clouds. There's hard work going on. What do you see that makes you say that? Homer shows us the breaking of the waves by the texture and the colors in the water. The men appear to be straining to keep the boat upright. And based on Homer's use of space, the sailors appear to be very far away from any help. What's the rest of the story? We could imagine the relationship of the people in the boat. Possibly they were surprised by the storm. What will their fate be if the storm continues? With their notes, students utilize their grammar skills in a Mad Lib style fill-in-the-blank worksheet, but with art as their inspiration. Here is an example by a fifth grade student. Clouds. Gray. Ominous. Blowing, tossing, shaking. They cover like shrouds with restless power. Storm. Moving up in grade level, art can also be used as a springboard for writing haikus. As always, we must take the time to really look at the artwork. I've included a way here for the students to actually take notes on the artwork being viewed in preparation for writing the poetry. Now, I'm not going to fill in every single blank here, and I actually don't expect the students necessarily to fill in every blank. Again, this is just another way to force the students to actually spend time with the art. You'll see that I start with having them fill in six adjectives, or a general amount of adjectives, to describe the artistic style, the way it's painted. That brings in our elements of art. Adjectives that describe the emotions of the work of art. It can either be the emotions expressed in the art or how it makes the individual feel. This is getting a little deeper into the meaning of this art. Verbs that describe the subject matter of the art. Similes and metaphors that might be expressed in this artwork. This leads to our haiku, and here's an example from a 10th grade student. And this is perfect for this time of year. Summer's Promise. gentle evening breeze, floral scent of paradise. Memories linger. Now, art is such a wonderful catalyst for teaching history. It can not only reinforce historical details, but can also reflect the attitudes and human, intellectual, and emotional responses of people to the events of their times. This piece by Norman Rockwell, along with many of his other works, lends itself to being viewed as we would a short story, with all the narrative elements, only in a visual format. In order to break down the narrative elements, I use a chart that my students and I will complete together. After giving the students time to look closely at the art, we begin by filling in the section on setting. Where is the story happening? I'll get answers such as an alley, a big city. Next, we fill in the characters of the story. They might say something like an artist, a music teacher, a children, dog, a postman, music student, window washer, truck driver. What is the actual event that is happening here? We may hear the dog is blocking the truck. And then finally, we list all of the things, could be objects, or the feelings or emotions that are evident in this scene. It might also include vocabulary words, if that were appropriate for this particular piece of art. So I might get answers for the feelings of surprise, anger, curiosity. And then some of the things that lead us to this are the truck, squeegee, a violin. Now, throughout this discussion, I'm going to constantly probe with, how do you know? So if my students are answering, well, this is an alley in a big city. Well, how do you know that it's in a big city? Well, first they're going to tell me, this certainly doesn't look like the suburbs in Cary, North Carolina, with a nice little yard around their nice little house. Obviously, we see in this picture that this is a very narrow drive, and we see people that appear to be living in maybe their homes as well as businesses, and we would not find that in a suburb. We'd only find that in a big city. And then I might ask about the feelings that they expressed here. So students are always eager to tell me all of the different emotions because Norman Rockwell captures these so dramatically and always has so much feeling and character in his characters. So if I have a student that tells me, well, I see surprise. Well, that's great. How do you know? And the first thing they're going to do is they're going to go like this. And that's great. That's visual. What I want is verbal. How do you know that there's someone in this scene that is surprised? And in this particular case, I would expect them to give me the verbal image of there's a woman hanging over the balcony with her hands on her face and her mouth wide open and her eyes are big and wide. So I'm going to want to hear details of them talking about the different elements in this scene. And so to conclude, then I'll have a student give a summary of this story based on the information we have gathered from the picture. Now, we've already said that the story is that there is a dog blocking the truck. But along with this, what helps us is that we know that this is in a big city. This truck is having a hard time getting through this narrow little alley, and here's this little dog blocking the way. But we have so many people here that are engaged in this story. We have the truck driver that is clearly angry as he looks on with a scrunched up face and angry eyes as he's looking at this dog. And yet there's someone else from the same that probably is with the driver that is trying desperately to get that dog to get out of the way. But then we have all of these other people that are in their everyday lives taking music lessons, because we see that there's a young man carrying a violin case, and we see a sign that shows that there are violin lessons in here. We see a man hanging out the window with a squeegee, so we know that he's a window washer. We have all of this going that creates the idea of this traffic jam in this scene. So after we have gone through this example, I'm able to use this format to introduce many different works as a group activity. Now, I'm sure all of you sitting there thought you were just going to be sitting listening to me, and unfortunately, I'm going to have to get you out of your seats because I am going to need some volunteers. What I'm going to ask is that I would like some volunteers to come up front. The only thing I'm going to expect you to do, I do not expect you to draw anything, so no worries there. The only thing I expect you to do is to look at some great art. Can I get about 8 volunteers? I know that's a lot in here. You know, in my classroom, what I might do is pick you. Yeah, and yes, come on down, come on down. Yes, come on down. Oh, yes, ladies, come on down. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. One more. Yes, thank you. Come on down. I really want you to see a visual of how this activity can work so well with a group of students. All right, so my volunteers here. I need 2 people to stand right here. 2 people are going to stand right here. I need 2 here and 2 here. Thank you for being so willing to help with this. Great, and I need 1 more there. All right, at the front here, what my wonderful volunteers see is that I'm going to hand one person that is in a group. You guys are a group together, actually, so you're going to be working together. So I'm going to have you slide over right here, and I'm going to give you a pencil. You are the lucky keeper of the pencil. Did I miss someone? Oh, I was supposed to have 8, 2, 4, 6. I need Mrs. Pettit's coming on down. All right, and so I'm going to give you a pencil here, and you're right there, and I'm going to give you the pencil there. Now, the group up front here, what they will see in front of them is I do have a picture that they're going to be looking at, but I have it upside down to start because I don't want the students to get distracted by the picture while I'm giving instructions. And the other thing that they will see is they will see a copy of my worksheet, and at the top I do have the title of the art that they're going to look for. So it is important to use whatever clues you've got, and in this case the title can be quite helpful in the pictures that I have chosen for them. So here's how this works. Now in my classroom I can break out my tables and set them in groups so that I generally can have 4 groups going at a time, and my groups tend to be 4 to 6 students. That's probably the maximum you'd want to have in any one group, because then it's too easy for students to not be as engaged. So I wouldn't go more than 6, but if you can break it out that way, and you don't have to use 4 pictures, you can use 2, you can use 6. It's really very flexible depending on the lesson that you are trying to give at that time. So they have the worksheet. Now, what's going to happen is this group right here, these 2 volunteers, are going to be working on the setting. And so when I tell them to, they're going to flip over their picture, and then they are going to work together to decide what is the setting, where is this picture happening. And they're going to write down the information in the block that says setting. All answers are valid. And this is important for the students in that sometimes they'll be surprised. They may not all agree on where they think the setting is. And that's okay, because that's why we will discuss it after we're done. So it is important to have your student understand that even if they disagree, the person that has the pencil, even if they disagree, they're going to write it down anyway, because we're going to talk about, and there may be some surprises there. So this group is the setting. This group right here is going to be looking for the characters, all the wonderful characters in the scene. This group is going to be telling us, what's the event? What's happening? What's the event? And this lovely group right here is going to be listing the things or the feelings. Now, in Norman Rockwell's work, there tend to be, you know, an abundance of the things or feelings and people in there. That's not always going to be the case in art, and that is totally okay. And that's what makes this fun, because it can kind of reveal things about different artwork that you don't expect. And so again, what will happen is I'm going to give them just a brief time. Obviously, I can't give them as long as I would normally give in the classroom to look at the piece of art. And they're going to work together to write down just quickly for this group what the setting is, for this group what the characters are, for this group what the event is, and for this group what the things or feelings are. Now, once they have done that with the picture that they're looking at, I will say, after a short amount of time for this group, I'll say, stop, put your pencil down. And then we will all move, in terms of these groups, to our right. Everybody raise their right hand, yes. Thank you. We're going to move to our right. And so what will happen is this group will move on to the next picture and so on. But you will still just be filling out the setting, and you'll still just be working on the characters, and you'll still just be working on the event, and you'll still just be working on the things or the feelings. So that by the time we go all the way around, every single sheet will be filled in all four sections, and then we'll be able to have a wonderful discussion about that. All right, so when I say go, you're going to go ahead and flip over your picture and take a moment to look at it. Like I said, I'm only going to give you about a minute or so, so do the best you can. You may not have that much to fill in, but do the best you can. On your mark, get set, go. All right, while they are doing that, these are the images that they are looking at right now. And so in my classroom, I would be going around from table to table to make sure that everyone is engaged and everyone is viewing the picture and that all answers are being accepted and written down, because again, they will be surprised that sometimes what they think is going on is not actually what is going on. And so this just gives us a great way to talk about it. All right, stop, put your pencil down. You are going to move to your right. You ladies are going to have to come around probably this way. As soon as you get to your picture, go ahead and start. Remember, you're still filling in the same section that you started this with. It should. All right, stop. Put your pencil down. Oh, that's okay. No worries. All right, move to your right. You guys are going to come along here. Again, I would certainly give more time to my students. Go ahead and get started as soon as you get to your spot. Cheating. Stop, put your pencil down. Let's move on. Last one. I've got some cheaters up here. We don't encourage that. All right, stop, put your pencil down. All right, thank you so much to my volunteers. You guys have been wonderful. Y'all can have a seat. You were very helpful. All right, I'm going to go ahead and start. at this point, I would go through what the students have written. I'm going to start with the freedom of speech that you see at the top, because this actually was the first of this series that Norman Rockwell completed. Now, it is not necessarily important for you to know all of the backstory on this. I'm going to give you just a little bit of backstory on this piece just to get us started, but you don't necessarily have to. I don't want any classroom teachers to hesitate in using artwork just because they feel like they're not qualified and know everything about the details of the history of the artist or the artwork. But in this particular case, the Freedom of Speech actually was the first one of the Freedom series that Norman Rockwell did, and he did it based on a personal experience of going to a town hall meeting that he went to, and in that meeting, there was one person that disagreed with everyone else in the meeting. And yet, that person was able to stand up and speak, and everyone attentively listened to what he had to say. Not quite sure that would happen today, unfortunately, but in the 40s, this is what he was illustrating for freedom of speech. Now, as I'm going through the what was written here, I have a setting in which the people say that this was a school, and realize that they had better copies. I do recommend having real images and not just images on a board. I know some of you are so far away, you really hard for you to see as much detail here, but I do recommend having regular images and not just something on a board. They say it was a school, a town meeting in the evening, and it was crowded. Great answers. The characters are men, boys, citizens. Fabulous. The event was a town hall, a budget. There is detail in there that you could have gotten that from based on what's in people's hands. Things are feelings. They are supportive. They're listening intently. They're addressing. Think about how you could integrate this into a study talking about the freedom of speech. This certainly would be one way to illustrate that well in your communicating about history. This is great. And this, obviously, you guys are far ahead some of the younger students that might not have any reference of this. So this is great to where you can work back and forth with your students to understand what this is communicating to us. Now, as I move on to freedom of worship, we have a gathering. It's a church. It's a revival, maybe, prayer meeting. The characters, there's an old men and women, Catholics. It always makes me laugh. Even y'all put old people. Are these all old people? When I get my third graders doing this, they're all so old. And I'm thinking, I don't know, some of them look like they're my age. So even you guys put old people and Catholics on there, and that's great. The event, all nations, a worship service. Things or feelings are thoughtful, they're focused, they're distant, intense, hands praying. All right, I'm going to quickly go through the rest of this. We're going to look at freedom from fear. The setting is a bedroom. It's at night. It's a family home. It's city. There's war. You guys can't read it, but there actually is a headline on that newspaper that should be a clue. Characters, there's a family, a mom, a dad, and two children. The event are sick children. They're secure, and they're sleeping. The things are feelings. Sad, concerned, boys not feeling well, dad interrupted, irritated. Maybe. See, now these are interesting comments, and this gives you a chance to talk about what details were missing. There is a detail that if you looked closely, again, this kind of goes with my chicken, you need to look closely. It talks about war on that newspaper headline and bombings. This is a great opportunity to talk about how here in America, we didn't have that worry. We didn't have bomb shelters where we had to go in the subways and hide. And this particular scene, actually the children are not sick. They're just going to bed in a normal way with a family that is tucking them in, worried about the war coming onto our shores. And then finally, freedom from want. It's a setting. It's a family dinner, dining room, a country house, daytime. It's a holiday. Characters, large family, multiple generations, men, women, children. The event is a Thanksgiving. It's a family. Things or feelings, excitement, joy, feasting. All of these are great answers. Now, as we are looking, as we have finished all of that up, what I want you to be thinking about is imagine the opportunity you would have with all of these to integrate lessons on World War II or the Constitution, or even I focus a lot on the discussion of needs versus wants when we look at freedom from want. There's so much to be discussed in that. Don't be afraid too. This happened to be, you know, a series that I put all together because in my classroom we're studying Norman Rockwell. But don't be afraid to use multiple artists to teach different historical details and attitudes. For instance, when teaching about the French Revolution, you could use the Rococo paintings of Watteau and Fragonard to showcase the lifestyle of the nobles that had all this leisure time to be swinging around at a picnic in dresses with fur and satin. Then you can contrast it with other works that graphically reveal the poverty of the French working class who supported this nobility. The historical possibilities really are endless. And if you're unsure about where to find appropriate art, start with the images from your history textbooks. There are almost always classic artwork included in each period. The only difference is that most students only look at them in passing and aren't given the opportunity to integrate the information with the written record. How much more could they retain if they were able to pull up visual clues to those written lessons? So finally, incorporating art into your overall scheme of teaching enables you to teach critical and analytical skills. It emphasizes investigation, figuring out what questions to ask, how to approach finding out the answers to those questions, and determining connections between the questions and the answers. I found that many classroom teachers are initially reluctant to incorporate art into their normal teaching because of a lack of artistic training. But as I hope that I've shown you today, one doesn't have to be an art historian to teach the history and language revealed in art. You simply need to have the confidence in your own capacity and your students' capacity to look closely at a work of art and consider what's revealed in it. Thank you so much for being here.